We have been considering Paul's argument in Galatians 5, verses 7 through 12, and we come to a semi-crucial place this evening in verse 11, because in our former studies, we have seen that the Galatians, as the paragraph opens, had been living a certain way, and Paul calls that running well. And then they began to shift the style of life that they were living, the mechanism and the methodology of that life. And Paul calls that being hindered from being persuaded by the truth. He says, verse 8, that this persuasion didn't come from the one who calls you. And the calling God in verse 6 of chapter 1 is calling into grace. So that sets the stage for this idea that the issue here is that God has summoned us into a relationship with Him rooted in grace. And then He makes this real critical statement about a little leaven leavening the whole lump. So that you have a dangerous situation in that anything that you fully embrace, and I realize that fully embrace is relative, but any concept that you believe and continue to believe after it has been sharpened by conflict with it and argument against it and experience that doesn't line up with it and you still hold on to it, that kind of thing has the power to pervasively impact your entire outlook. And it can do it negatively as well as positively. A little bad leaven will leaven the whole lump in a negative way. And yet, leaven as a concept, if you hang on to something that's really true and you hang on to it through all that, it also will do some really good things because it'll pervasively work its way through your life too. So, at the issue in all of this, the bottom line, obviously, is a person's experience, both in time and eternity. Our experience is a quality of existence, and that quality of experience is either life or death, and it's always determined by what you believe. Because what you believe conditions your responses to the things that happen to you, so that if the thing that happens to you is received by you as a very good thing, then you have a lot of giddy feelings of great happiness and whatever. And if the thing that happens to you is something that you really didn't want to have to deal with at all, then you have a different kind of reaction. But all of those issues of reaction are faith held. And it depends on what you've believed. And a little leaven leavens the whole lump. So it makes a lot of difference what you believe. And faith in a lie will ultimately ruin your life. Whereas faith in the truth will eventually lead you into a boundless experience of the joy of life. So what we believe is critical for time and eternity. Therefore, the most natural question in the world is, who should I believe? And that's the crux of verses 7 through 12, because there are two competing presenters of doctrinal concepts that are both being held or professed to be true. There's Paul and his opponents. So the question of who to believe, though it's already been in a very real sense answered. Chapters 1 and 2 were a comprehensive presentation of the reasons why you ought to believe that Paul is a legitimate spokesman for God and that what he has to say is trustworthy and therefore anything he writes is believable. And you shouldn't have to worry about it. The problem is that those big ticket things, chapters 1 and 2, have in this paragraph what we'll just call an addendum. The two chapters present the basis for faith and biblical truth, but what Paul has to say in this paragraph in chapter 5 has something to do with something that chapters 1 and 2 really didn't directly address, or at least we didn't focus on it when we were there. The issue for the Galatians is that Paul's not on the scene. The opponents are on the scene. The arguments that Paul made while he was there seemed to be persuasive, and they bought into them to some level. And the false teachers that have come on the scene are presenting their arguments, and they sound logical and rational and believable, and so they have been dissuaded from holding on to what they've been taught, and now they're being persuaded to believe something else. And the question is, how are the Galatians supposed to handle this tension of being confronted by competing doctrines when Paul's not personally on the scene? And I believe that verses 11 and 12 address that in a kind of a, well, it addresses it directly, but it does it from another angle. And that angle is the issue of the personal motivation of the doctrine generator. There is in the New Testament requirements in Paul's writings for leadership in the church a forbidding of allowing anybody to be in leadership in the church who has a violent temper. He can't be a person who enforces his will with his fists. He can't be a violent agitator. He can't be somebody who's willing to force his will by the threat of violence and that kind of thing. And that fits this setting in Galatia to a T, because Paul is going to argue here in verses 11 and 12 that if you're willing to force your agenda with violence, which is what persecution is, then your doctrine's wrong. It doesn't matter what words you use, your doctrine's wrong. Because the real issue in this paragraph is, whose doctrine do we believe? And it's no accident that false systems of doctrine generally look with favor on persecution of the opponents. It's not an accident that the Roman Catholic Church had the Inquisition, and they actively tortured and killed people in the name of preserving the truth. It's no accident that John Calvin, once he got into the driver's seat in Geneva, persecuted unto death those that didn't agree with him. It's no accident that violence is the outflow of power when people want to exercise power. But that whole desire to force your point of view by the exercise of power is a guarantee that the doctrine's off. That's Paul's argument in verses 11 and 12. But there's kind of a little twitch in it, because it's obvious from verse 10 and 12 that Paul has a bad attitude toward these. What we would call a bad attitude. It's not. I mean, obviously, he wouldn't have written this if it was a bad attitude, but it's obviously a different attitude than most people would embrace. You know, we're supposed to love our enemies. We're not supposed to hope they cut themselves off. You know, we're not supposed to wish judgment on people, are we? Well, Paul didn't seem to have any problem with it. So, what we're going to be dealing with this evening is the issue of purity of doctrine arising out of a purity of motivation. And one of the most basic issues in verses 11 and 12 is the statement that the stumbling block of the cross has been abolished. The most basic issue in Galatia, the most basic issue in this letter, is the set of nuances that come off of the message of the cross. In Galatians 3, Paul said that he had set forth Jesus Christ crucified as an argument rooted in Old Testament revelatory information about the necessity for the death of the Savior. And it's Isaiah 53 as a classic, but so is Psalm 22, the my God, why hast thou forsaken me? There are a lot of places in the Old Testament that taught that the Messiah was going to suffer and die. And it was such a strong teaching, as well as a contrast to the messianic identity of Christ as the conquering king, that the Jewish theologians in the first century and before had developed a concept of two Christs. One was a suffering servant and one was a glorious, victorious ruler. And they called the one Messiah ben Joseph, who was the suffering servant who ended up in prison and then God exalted him. And the other was Messiah ben David, because David was the man of war who conquered all the enemies and set the kingdom on its feet and all that. So you had these Messiah ben, son of concepts. And that proves that the Old Testament scriptures that those concepts arose from the study of taught them. Their problem was they thought it meant two messiahs. Our solution after the New Testament is that it's two comings, same messiah, two different comings. But the point that I want to make here is that this issue of the nuances of the message of the cross is central in Galatians 3:1. Paul's argument is that this was Old Testament, demonstrated in fact in history, and it was right there in front of them, in their face. And this crucifixion of the Christ is actually, I believe, the ultimate core of all theology. I don't see any attribute of God that doesn't have a most fundamental explanation in the crucifixion. It's the crux of the wisdom of God in 1 Corinthians 1:24. It explains at least some of the boundaries of the use of and refusal to use omnipotence on God's part. Matthew 27:40. If you're the Son of God, come down. Aren't you powerful enough to come down? Well, yeah. But there are too many things that would be sacrificed if I were to exercise my power that way. So it addresses the question of God's use of omnipotence. John 3:16 tells us pointedly that the cross is the core of the demonstration of the love of God. In some ways, the crucifixion of the Son of God presents an unfathomable, I can't even say the word, but one of those mysteries of the unity of God that has plurality of personality within unity. And you can have personalities within the Godhead acting different ways in different settings. And according to Romans chapter 3, verse 26, the crucifixion was the most direct example of the justice of God, where he vented his justice against a person that was willing to be guilty of all of the sin. And the Bible says that the cross was so God could be just and justifier. So it addresses the justice. I really think that you can put a capital ETC after that, etc. The issues of God's character have a core in the cross. And I believe that in verse 11, when he says the stumbling block of the cross has been abolished, that he's actually pushing us back to chapter 3, verse 1, where the Christ crucified is the core. And he even says in chapter 3, are you so foolish, having begun this way, that you're going to be completed another way? And it all comes back to this issue of a substitutionary actor who acts on your behalf, so that you get credit for what he does when you trust him. That's the grace of God. And, of course, the cross addresses grace, most fundamentally. So, when Paul makes the crucifixion, he makes the cross, in verse 11, the central issue, and he says that there is a body of doctrine that would abolish the cross. And there is another body of doctrine, and of course he'd call that false doctrine if it abolishes the cross or the impact of it. But there is a body of doctrine that makes the cross the central core. And it's his argument in this paragraph that the way you can tell whether doctrine's true or not true is what it does with the nuances of the cross. So that's the background in the context, the larger context of Galatians. But in our current text, Paul is actually addressing what he calls, what the New American Standard translates as the stumbling block of the cross. The word is skandalon, and we get our word scandal from it, and that's a pretty good idea, depending on how you understand scandal. We had a Sunday school class this morning in which the passage in 1 Timothy, if we deny him, he will deny us, was raised, and somebody immediately says, what do you mean by deny? And the reason the question is raised is because everything hinges on definition. It's how you define your terms that makes your doctrine what it is. And the same thing's true here when we talk about a scandal or a stumbling block. What's he mean by that? What is the stumbling block of the cross that is abolished if he preaches circumcision? So that's what's going on here. And the word that's translated stumbling block or scandal is used in the New Testament in multiple places, and what you discover if you look at them is that it refers to pretty much anything that is sufficiently offensive as to cause a person to respond in an ungodly way. In other words, an offense is something that gets somebody to do something ungodly. So that you're not supposed to put a stumbling block in front of your brother, because what that means is you're not supposed to do anything that would cause him to turn around and do something that would be characterized as ungodliness. And that doesn't mean that the stumbling block that you put before him makes him angry. The stumbling block you put before him, that because you did it and he has respect for you, that he'll copy your example in doing an ungodly thing called, fundamentally, violating his conscience. And that is, by the way, one of the biggest issues of stumbling, is when a person is willing to violate his conscience. So in the scriptures, you have this offensive thing that causes people to react in an ungodly way. Now, when Paul uses this concept in his writings, it's interesting that in 1 Corinthians 1:23, he deliberately chooses to use this stumbling block concept, or the offense of the cross concept, as a particularly applicable concept when it's talking about Jews. He says in 1 Corinthians, to the Jews the cross is a stumbling block. To the Greeks, it's foolishness. Well, it's not hard to understand that terminology in that context, because foolishness to a Greek who is enamored with the logic and rational thought of the human mind and all that, the entire idea that you can win by losing, that you can live by dying, that the cross can lead to glory, that's just foolishness. You're not going to get anywhere going that way, they would say. If you want to live, you've got to do everything you can do to keep from dying. Whereas the cross says, no. If you want to live, you've got to go through the grave to get there. And to the Greek mind, that's just nuts. But to the Jewish mind, it's not nuts. It's a stumbling block. It's an offense. So, one of the questions that we have to raise here in verse 11, because Paul is dealing with a Jewish issue, because it's the Jews that have come to Galatia to corrupt the Gentiles' understanding of the gospel. He is saying that the stumbling block of the cross has been abolished if he is still preaching circumcision, if he, as Paul, is still preaching circumcision. Why am I being persecuted, he says. And the outworking of it would be that the stumbling block of cross has been removed, set aside. So what is the stumbling block? Well, what was the Jews' major problem? Well, if you read Romans chapter 2, the last half of the chapter, you come off of that chapter with the understanding that Paul considered the Jewish problem as fundamentally the pride of life. The Jewish problem was fundamentally a persuasion that they held that they themselves were capable of being superior to every other race or nationality of human beings because they could keep the law of God. They boasted in having a revelation of the will of God in the law, and they boasted in their performance of it. And Paul just eats them up in chapter 2 of Romans with this arrogance thing, and he challenges it on the face of it. You who say, you shall not covet. Do you collect high-priced items from the Gentiles' idolatry? Why would you do that if you're not being covetous? And yet you're saying that you should obey the law, which not only says don't have any idols, it also says don't covet. So Paul in Romans 2 takes on the Jewish arrogance. And the reason he can do it so effectively is because he was one of them for so long. It was his goal in life to prove that he was the superior disciple of God in his generation. That was his goal in life. He says that in chapter 2, or chapter 1 of Galatians. It's his goal in life. So the Jewish mindset is this idea that we're superior based on our fidelity, loyalty, goodness, our obedience, all of those things. And Paul says, the cross says, that all of that is nonsense. It's an offense. The cross is an offense to anybody who really believes in their abilities. Because the cross was totally unnecessary. If you could qualify yourself before God by obedience, then why did Jesus die? What were all these Old Testament passages about the Messiah having to suffer and die? What were they all about if you really can be as good as you try to get everybody to believe you are? So that the preaching of the cross was a preaching that said, in effect, you're corrupt to the core. Therefore, you have no hope of salvation out of yourself. None. And for a Jew to swallow that was just too much. So what Paul is dealing with here is that the accusation of the cross, that men need a Savior who can do for them because they can't do it themselves, the accusation of that kind of ungodliness was such an offense to the Jewish mind that it would cause them to react in an ungodly way. That's what a stumbling block does. It causes people to react in an ungodly way. Well, what ungodly way does Paul highlight here? That is their reaction to the preaching of the cross. It's right there in the middle of the verse. I'm being persecuted. These people don't like my message, and because they don't like what my message implies about them, they have resorted to violence to shut me up. That's the issue of persecution. Persecution only has one goal, and that is to force the person who is in opposition to yield. So that he is not in opposition any longer. That's the entire purpose of persecution. There is no rationale for persecution except to compel by force a person to change the opposition that he's giving to the agenda. So when Paul raises this issue in verse 11, the stumbling block of the cross, and he's saying that there is a body of doctrine that will completely eliminate the need for the cross, it will eliminate the offense of the cross. And that body of doctrine is the doctrine that you can qualify yourself before God by your choices and your obedience. And because you can qualify yourself that way, you don't have to consider yourself as hopeless, as corrupt, as a sinner, and all that. You can hold on to your good opinion of yourself and qualify yourself, and then the cross is unnecessary. And the depth that these Jewish people held this with was so profound that it sponsored murder on a regular basis. That's why Jesus was crucified. They didn't crucify him because of some minor something. They crucified him because his message was fundamentally so contrary to what they wanted to be true that they couldn't stand it. And they felt like the only thing they could do was shut him up by killing him. There's a whole line of prophets that have been put to death because their message was too unpopular. And Paul is asking the question in verse 11, if his message is a variation of circumcision, then it shouldn't lead to persecution, but it will lead to an abolishing of the message of the cross and the stumbling block of the cross. And therefore, verse 11 fits into that setting because what we're talking about here is who should I believe? And in our text here, the issue of who should I believe is answered this way. You should believe in the person who is being persecuted, not the persecutors. You should not believe anybody whose bottom line is force to compel you to stop opposing their message. You shouldn't believe anything they have to say. Some of the words they say will be true, but you still shouldn't believe them. Because a little leaven leavens a whole lump. And whatever the words they are that they say that are true will be corrupted by all the words that they say that are not true. And since they're teaching and you're receiving, you just block them all out. because they're not trustworthy. The person that you ought to believe is the person who's willing to be persecuted and not to persecute. Because the willingness to not persecute means that you're confident enough that your understanding of the thing is true so that you don't have to force anybody to agree with you. But we have a caution in verse 10 and 12 that makes us have to think our way through this issue, because there's no question that verse 10 just point blankly says that the one who's disturbing you will bear his judgment, whoever he is. And that's an echo, as we said last time, back to chapter 1, where even if it's an angel from heaven, he's going to be accursed if he preaches this. Verse 12, would that those who are troubling you would even mutilate themselves. That's pretty graphic. We'll talk about it a little bit more perhaps next week, depending. But anyway, the graphic presentation there is that he hopes that while they're circumcising themselves, they'll slip and cut themselves off. And I'll just let it go at that. But that kind of graphic tone and language indicates that Paul's pretty strongly antagonized by these folks, and he wishes some bad things had happened to them. You say, okay, has Paul just shot himself in the foot? Has he said, don't trust anybody who has such a terrible attitude toward those that oppose him? I didn't say that. I said you shouldn't trust anybody who's willing to use violence to force his view on those who oppose him. Paul didn't say he wanted to execute this judgment in verse 10 or to accomplish the action in verse 12. He didn't say that he wanted to do that. The real issue in Paul's description of his real attitude, which is strongly antagonistic, is the actual reaction of ungodliness. And that is not what a person wants to see happen. It's what a person is willing to do to make it happen. There's a huge difference between wanting something to happen and being committed to forcing it to occur. It's not what you want to have happen that qualifies your doctrine as good or not. It's what you're willing to do to make sure that it does happen. And Paul's argument in multiple places, for example, he said in Romans that you shouldn't seek vengeance. But what does he say you should do? You should give place, because vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, I will repay. Well, how much encouragement is, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, I will repay, to somebody who doesn't want vengeance to be repaid? How much encouragement is it? None. So there is a legitimacy in truth for a person to want somebody to have to suffer the consequences of his evil. Vengeance. In the book of the Revelation, the people have been martyred for their faith in Christ. Their souls are under the altar and they're crying out, how long, Lord, are you going to let this go on until you avenge our blood on those that are on the earth? How long? He says, rest. It's coming. You're going to get what you want. Just take it easy. Give it a little time. Rest. Is he saying, you shouldn't be thinking those kind of thoughts. You shouldn't be wanting them people to suffer the consequences of their bad, evil, wicked ways. He didn't say that. He's not saying that Paul was wrong in verse 10 or 12 either. What he's saying is there's a fundamental, theological, faith-based reason for restraining yourself in your wants. And Paul's argument is, you cannot trust anybody to tell you the truth if that somebody who's telling you that doesn't have a theological basis for restraining themselves from the execution of the divine prerogatives. If you can't let God be the one who's going to do the execution of retribution, if you can't let the law of the harvest handle the people who are doing the evil, then your doctrine's not trustworthy because you don't have enough faith in the God who has cautioned you to back off and let him be the God in the situation. And that's really the Galatian issue. The people who are teaching that you're in control of your own destiny by your choices and your obedience and your behavior, you can make things work out your way by the way you act. You can, in fact, compel God to allow you into his heaven by doing all the things he commands so that you can argue that you ought to have a place there. In fact, there are going to be some that are going to argue that. Jesus said in the days that come, in the day of judgment, there are going to be some who say, "But Lord, I did this in your name, and I did that in your name, and I did this other thing in your name, and you owe me a place there." That's a little bit of an addition. But that's the point of the argument. And he says, "I'm going to tell them, get out of here. I never knew you." And the reason I didn't is because the root issue of staying in control is the issue of who's going to be God. So if a person is unwilling to let God be God in the issues of persecution and violence, if he's not willing to let God be God, you can't trust him. That's his whole bottom line. Who should you trust? You should trust the person who's not trying to be God. And it shows up when everything's blowing up in his face. Because in verse 11, the preaching of the cross is causing enormous persecution to come back on the preacher. Okay, what's the preacher to do in that situation? Well, Paul would argue that he'll keep on telling you the truth because the persecution issues are not his to handle. Those are God's issues to handle. He'll bear his own judgment, whoever he is. But I won't be executing the judgment. Jesus will. Even in verse 12, those who trouble you, I wish that they'd mutilate themselves. That's really an issue of whether or not they can control the law of the harvest in their own situation. Not me. Paul's not saying, "I want to do this to them. I just wish it happened." So the point is that Paul's argument basically boils down to the question that he raises. If I'm still preaching circumcision, why am I still being persecuted? Because the stumbling block of the cross is erased by the preaching of circumcision, and I'm being persecuted because I haven't stopped preaching the cross. That means that he refuses to insist on a theological construct that leaves human beings in control. And that's what legalism is. It's a doctrine that allows people to be in control. They decide how it's going to operate. And that wouldn't be a bad thing if Genesis 3 weren't true. But it is. Therefore, the desire to be in control has been twisted into a fulfillment of the issue that Satan promised. Ye shall be as Elohim, the executor of power. You can be your own God. Well, anybody whose doctrine is a reflection of that, you can control your own life, the quality and all of the rest. You can do this. You have the ability. Anybody whose doctrine runs back to that root, you cannot trust. According to Paul's doctrine of grace, the outcomes have always got to be left up to the grace of God, which basically boils down to this. He decides. That's what grace is all about. It's divine prerogative in good things, and that's where you have to leave it. Paul even said to the Corinthians, "I sowed, Apollos watered, but God gives increase." I think that they got the right. But anyway, some sow, some water, but God gives increase. Well, if I sow, then I ought to be able to control the increase. If I'm the irrigator, I ought to have some credit for controlling or having the increase. And Paul says, no, not under grace. You do your job, you let the outcome be up to God. Because that's what grace is all about, is being up to God. That works in our favor. The outcomes of grace for those who allow it are extremely good. Grace never works against you if you're willing to yield to it. But grace will work against you if you're not. Because grace, by definition, is, I don't have to do this if I don't want to, God says. So, you better put that in your pipe and smoke it. You better think about that, because when you try to force me, you're putting our relationship on a legal basis, and that's no basis for relationship at all, and I'm not going to have it. That's the issue of grace. So, Paul would say then that the apostles clearly insist upon a connection between persecution and doctrine. False doctrine allows those who are teaching it to use persecution as a method to force their doctrine into place. True brethren depend on the grace of God in all things so that they deliberately refuse to use force to make their doctrine work. They refuse. They'll use argument. Paul's letter to the Galatians. Persuasive argument. But he's not going to force it. Because a true believer in the issue of doctrine is somebody who allows God to be God. So, the larger point in this text, in verses 7 through 12, the question of who should I believe? Well, just ask yourself this. Who's willing to resort to violence to make sure their doctrine carries the day? And don't trust them. That's his argument here. Does that raise questions or comments?